In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Yeah, we are back. Lucky 13, the 13th of January. And back in the saddle. I'm Alec Hogan. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this first episode of the Biz News Briefing for 2025. There's quite a lot about muck in this program. Not us, I hope, but the coverage that we have on it. We're going to hear from Gigi Alcock a little later about the real reason why those kids died of eating poison snacks. But before we get there, there's a bit of muck going on in the discussion between my colleague Chris Stain and Neil De Beer in the Sunday show. So we pulled out the part of the muck, which actually does not reflect terribly well on South Africa's deputy president. Let's have a watch.
Now, Khayelitsha, where the president made his speech, has also become the battleground between Vice President Paul Mashatile and Democratic Alliance Federal Chair Ms. Helen Zille.
Yeah, he goes and he stands in the middle of Khayelitsha, making sure that the cameras can see the mountain heaps of rubbish behind him. Then he says, what's behind him is the proof that the DA City Council of Cape Town has absolutely no regard for the poor, and says that because there are such a tantamount amount of ministers of national regard around him, that it seemingly must be that the ANC must come back to Cape Town to fix things which the DA Cape Town cannot do. What a plonker. I mean, if you look at this man, you know, it's like he hit himself with a Bauer nonstick pan against his bloody head. I would like him to go to any of the informal settlements in the country right now. Diepsloot, Kwatema, Soweto, Langa, Khayelitsha.
His home ground.
Go stand there. So if I must go take a telephone camera and go stand in front of every rubbish dump that you can currently find in the country, then I will probably run out of bandwidth or data. What an absolute idiotic move. And the worst is, Chris, he's standing in that scenario and it's an ANC councillor's ward. Now the other thing is, Chris, is this the political shot that you should shoot? Is that a rubbish dump? And it's an ANC councillor's ward, and he never asked who put the rubbish there. So I think when I saw this little trilogy of pathetic tit for tat, I wanted to tell him, but Mr. Mashatile, take your jacket off and put the rubbish in your boot. Because, by the way, the car you are driving is paid for by state. So that was the shots that they now started to fire. Chris, I am a councillor of the city of Cape Town, by the way. And I can tell you that every day, the shocking news, by the way, is that when we sometimes send in our rubbish trucks to remove rubbish, we have to send the police with to escort. So, Mr. Mashatile, before you go stand in front of rubbish heaps to rubbish another party, maybe you should start asking your councillors and your ministers to come into your area and change their attitude, to change the fundamental problems we have as a society, to ask people not to burn stuff, not to just throw stuff, but to educate. because I am seeing an era where ambulances and fire trucks and rubbish trucks have to be escorted by police officers to go do that service delivery. So Mr. Mashatile is trying to be relevant. He's trying to give those digging shots because he cannot let the GNU go on because it will make him irrelevant. So, yeah, the firing shots happened on the ground, but let me tell you, it was hitting a buffalo with a ketty of an afgesaagde Windbugs air gun. Like nothing, actually just made him more pathetic.
Wow. Well, Neil is in hot form, as you can hear. So he has started the year on the front foot with Chris Steyn. You can see the full Sunday show recording. That's on BizNews TV. It's not just them where there's a bit of tit-for-tat politics. I had some interesting interviews last week, and the team have pulled together a compendium of what's going on between John Steenhuisen and Action SA. Just to bring you up to date, Action SA, which seems to be getting most of its voters from the DA, so in a way they're sucking votes from the DA in the same way, or attempting to anyway, that the EFF is sucking votes away from the ANC. Action SA accused John Steenhuisen of having a fleet of luxury SUVs. He said each of these vehicles, including three vehicles that they mentioned, and that those vehicles cost more than R1 million. We gave both parties their say. Let's have a watch.
John, I guess you could have hoped for a better start to the new year than getting attacked by Action SA. Let's start with the allegations of you having a, quote, multi-million rand blue light luxury SUV vehicle fleet.
So what are the facts, Alex? Let's set them out. Firstly, all ministers, not only in South Africa, all members of executive government are provided with official vehicles to conduct their official duties. These are not for personal use. They are for the execution of executive functions. When I assumed office as the Minister of Agriculture, I inherited an Audi A7 in Cape Town that had been purchased in 2019 and long paid off by the Department of Agriculture. It had been used by Toko Didiza in the past. It has 136,000 kilometers on the clock. And of course, I resisted the temptation and urge as new ministers come into office to purchase new vehicles. Instead, I said quite clearly, I'm happy to use the existing vehicle, mindful of the fact that we have to save costs. The situation was slightly more complex when it came to the official vehicle for Pretoria, because that vehicle was owned by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. And therefore, the Audi A7 that had been used by Minister Didiza there, also purchased in 2019, also with a similar mileage on the clock, had to then be transferred to Minister Nyonso. The department then came to me and said, well, look, we now need to buy you a new vehicle for your use in Pretoria. I insisted that there would be no new vehicle purchased. I instead asked them to bring me a schedule of all vehicles currently in the Agriculture Department's fleet. There I found a Toyota Prado that had been purchased in 2019. The car had around 230,000 kilometers on the clock. There was some concern expressed by the department because vehicles are supposed to, by handbook, be swapped out at 150,000 kilometers. I insisted, I'm quite happy with the Toyota Prado.
Why did your guys send a statement like that about Steenhuisen, which was patently wrong?
I made a commitment when I was elected that we would be a constructive opposition. And being in opposition requires certain things to be done. We didn't ask, you know, whether John Steenhuisen bought the cars or not, it's neither here nor there. He took over a department. He's the new minister of that department. And the department has spent money buying these motor cars. Now, the role of the opposition is to hold the executive to account. And the reason we released this statement about the DA and its leader and the Minister of Agriculture is that the DA have been on record saying that they will do away with all these perks. They've been bemoaning a bloated cabinet for the last 30 years in South Africa. And I know this because I was the leader of the opposition myself. I was a member of the same party as John Steenhuisen. I know the modus operandi. Up until they became part of the GNU, John Steenhuisen himself would ask the same questions annually to the ministers and release the same kind of statements. So I think he was just being a little bit thin-skinned about having been asked the question, because I guess now that the boot's on the other foot, he's a little bit more temperamental. He said he inherited cars, he took them over, they're 7 years old, they've got so many 100,000 kilometers on. Those were the responses he gave me. I have no parliamentary privilege outside of parliament. I have no privilege on the show of yours now. I must account for what I say. So I asked the question in writing. He responded in writing. I made a statement and attached the responses in writing. I hid nothing. So here's the point I want to make about these motor cars. Never once did we accuse John Steenhuisen of buying the motor cars. But I want to tell you right now, those seven-year-old vehicles are going to be scrapped very soon because the law says you may not travel in a vehicle above a certain kilometrage. So they will buy new vehicles, and the department will buy the vehicles. And we will ask the questions again next year, just like John Steenhuisen asked exactly this question last year when he was the leader of the opposition. It's not new.
And because these were inherited vehicles from two ministers, of course, the security features that were existing on the vehicles were there in place. Now, I'm not sure if Action South Africa, A, wants me to attend to my official duties on a bicycle, or they want me to now go to the expense of now removing these systems off these cars. If that'll make them happy, then, you know, I'd be quite happy to do so. But it's going to incur expenditure. Instead, like all DA ministers, we've instructed those who are responsible for driving these vehicles that blue lights or these security features are only able to be utilized in the case of a life or death situation where there is no alternative.
Helen Ziller made a statement publicly, and she said DA members of parliament and executive members will not use blue lights. That is a definitive statement. Now, in the United States, there's a massive anti-gun lobby. Those people who lobby against gun ownership, imagine if one of them was found carrying a gun and was asked by a journalist like Alec Hogg, why are you carrying a gun? And he'd say to you, no, I don't use it. It's just here for a case of emergency or a matter of life or death. Minister Groenewald has answered that he has had his blue lights removed from his motor car. Now, if you say you aren't going to use blue lights, you remove your blue lights.
Now, the hypocrisy that needs to be exposed here by Action South Africa is the fact that they currently have a mayor in Tshwane who utilizes two luxury BMW vehicles, both fitted with security features, for the execution of her official duties. Their speaker in the city of Johannesburg also has two luxury German sedans fitted with blue lights and security features, which she utilizes for the execution of her official duties. So what you have here is Action SA trying to manufacture a storm in a teacup.
So the Speaker of Johannesburg also inherited, quote unquote, one BMW X3 with over 100,000 kilometers on the clock. She has a driver and one close protection officer that travel in the same car, no tailing or follow-up support vehicle. So what he said was not true. Secondly, the mayor of Tshwane is also driven in an inherited entry-level BMW X3 sedan that Mayor Brink of the DA drove previously. She does have an escort because there's a provision in the local government act that the executive mayor has a vehicle with two following officers. So she is followed by a vehicle, an escort vehicle that follows her. So both of them also drive inherited vehicles. They are also secondhand, over 100,000, and they don't have two vehicles. John implied that they have two vehicles at their own disposal. They're not.
Well, it's quite a story. Depending on what side of the fence you're on, it does appear, though, that there's been a bit of a stretch in the truth. As far as Action SA is concerned, you can't say that Steenhuisen has got three luxury SUVs when he hasn't. You're trying to create the impression that he's using taxpayers' money to drive around in this little blue light fleet of his when it isn't true. Anyway, I hope that politics starts getting a little cleaner when we get into the rest of the year. We'll now hear more about that rubbish dump story today. I spoke with Gigi Alcock. Gigi is the expert on what he termed as cousinomics. It's about the informal sector. The premiere of the full interview is at 8 o'clock this evening. In fact, we've got a double feature for you, if you like. Gigi's at 8 o'clock, and then at 8:30, we have David Bacher looking back on 2024. You can hear a little bit from David in a moment. But let's go on to Gigi now, who tells us that with the whole deaths by the township kids who ate snacks allegedly bought from spaza shops, the kids are being used as a political tool. The politicians have climbed on the bandwagon. The real issue is, why was this industrial level pesticide being used by people in the townships in the first place? Gigi says that's the issue that the politicians should be focusing on and that we should be asking them about. Let's get a look at it.
It's very now commonplace to find this poisoning by these agricultural pesticides that are illegal for domestic use, but you know, people somehow they're getting onto the into people's homes and into spaza shops.
Needs must. But let's just follow the dots. So the municipalities are failing in their service delivery of picking up rubbish. So the rubbish is leading to an infestation of rodents and other pests. The people who live there, quite rationally, are going to find a way of protecting themselves against these pests. And so they are buying insecticides and poisons that you mentioned earlier are actually not approved for domestic use. So that has another implication, because they're going to be sold in spaza shops. And the problem that occurred was that in spaza shops, that poison somehow got into food, which killed children. So it all seems to be related from what you've told us.
Yeah. So look, I mean, the Minister of Health was quoted as saying that they inspected the knickknacks or whatever that were purchased by the kids who died from the spaza shop, and the knickknacks had no contamination, and so the pesticide clearly came from another source, and the source was in home. So that's the Minister Ellis Mitsoledi saying that. But at the same time, instead of then addressing the issues of why are we getting pesticides in people's homes, it's become a whole thing about foreign ownership of spaza shops. It's become outdated food. And there's no evidence at all, despite everything that they've done, that there's any outdated food that would have killed someone. I mean, apart from the fact that outdated food, you know, a packet of chips is going to be stale, so the kid probably won't eat it, but it's not going to kill you. So, you know, and again, it's become then this populist thing about getting the foreigners. We must get rid of the foreigners. And so they've jumped on that whole bandwagon. And the reality is that we have municipal bylaws that address health issues and stocking issues. They've just got to enforce that. Now what they've gone and done is they've said all these spaza shops have to be registered and foreigners can't register spazas. And then, of course, what happens is that, you know, by my figures, there's about 25 billion rand a year is earned by South African households renting out spazas to foreigners. Now, the minister and the presidency said, and Paul Mashatile the other day said, in December said, we're going to crack down on South Africans who are helping register spaza shops for foreigners. But what do they think? That, you know, people would just go and register a foreign spaza shop out of love for the Ethiopian. The reality is that there's a major business and incomes being earned by South Africans. And we should be recognizing those benefits and finding ways. Sure, they need to, you don't want illegal immigrants, but at the same time, we need to, you know, address it in a more realistic fashion, not to just crack down with a blunt object and remove incomes that households are earning from spaza rental. There's also a massive savings that consumers benefit from not paying a taxi to go to a shopping center, and so can buy goods closer to home. So there's all these kind of benefits they're ignoring in the process of kind of, in essence, what's a populist agenda.
More on that story, no doubt, as we go forward. Onto the news updates that we've got for you now from our partners at Bloomberg. Starting off with the oil price. You'll hear later in the program that the Sasol share price has started to finally pick up a little bit. And the reason for that is that the oil price has got to a four-month high. There are new sanctions on Russia, and these ones seem to be biting.
Talk us through the impact that these sanctions have had on the global oil markets, the details, why they are proving significant.
Well, this is the first time that the Biden administration, as their last sort of act, is putting real sanctions across the board on Russian oil. You know, they've hit the insurance companies. They've hit about two companies that handle 30% of the crude that comes out of Russia. And they've also hit over 150 oil tankers. All of that is much larger than the packages that they've done before and will make it more difficult for Russia to continue shipping crude, well, as long as incoming President Trump doesn't overturn it. Now, looking at the impact, some of the banks and analysts are saying that this could affect 800,000 to about shy of 1 million barrels a day. That's about 1% of global crude supply. That would affect mostly markets like India and China that were taking more Russian crude. And I have to remember that before this, the Biden administration was a bit more, they were taking a step back when it came to Russia and oil. They didn't want to cause any disruption to supply because that could affect prices. And on top of that, they put this price cap sort of mechanism in place to kind of reduce the amount of oil revenues that Moscow was making while keeping the barrels flowing into the market. This is a sort of turnaround to that policy and also a test for Trump.
Stephen, what then, given the action that we've seen and the fact that this is pretty broad-based, it is having that impact, what are expectations when you listen, when you're speaking to analysts in terms of how the oil story pushes forward from here in terms of pricing, with Brent now above $80 a barrel?
So there are two sort of things that the market will be watching closely. One will be, how effective are these sanctions? Will they stay in place? Will they actually reduce the amount of crude coming to the market? As I mentioned, some banks are saying this could affect as much as 800,000 barrels a day of oil being exported out of Russia. If that is the case, then you could see oil, which is in the $80 range, kind of trend more towards $90. There is no expectation that you're going to see a spike like we saw in 2022 after the war in Ukraine began and we were above $100 for Brent. Instead, you're going to see sort of a ratcheting up of prices where maybe the market wasn't expecting that. The second thing that you're going to have to watch as well is Iran and what Trump does with Iran. Trump has sort of said that he will put a tougher sort of stance on Iran and maybe enforce sanctions that have been in place that could also reduce the amount of oil coming out of that country. Further, another bullish element pushing prices up. But again, I do have to say that there isn't, as far as we've heard, any expectation that you're going to see any big spikes like we saw in 2022 in the oil market.
Well, next week, in fact, over the weekend, I'm flying off to the Alpine town, the highest town in Europe, Davos, to get my annual fix of what is happening in the world so that I can learn there and bring it back to you and relay to you the latest in the economic developments. This is the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. One of the things that I'm going to be focusing on a lot this time is artificial intelligence. 2 years ago, I went there, was exposed for the first time to artificial intelligence, came back, and we added Palantir and NVIDIA to our BizNews portfolios, much to the delight today of the tribe who followed us on those investments, the premium members. But before I start plugging in there, I've been looking around, and our partners at Bloomberg had a fascinating interview today with one of the early players at ChatGPT. Let's have a look at what he had to say to the Bloomberg interviewer.
Anytime a critical resource declines in cost this much or this quickly, there is a Cambrian economic explosion, and it is very good. We want, as people in this world, for important things to be inexpensive. That is good for society. This happened with water and foodstuffs, electricity, the internet. Happening with AI this much, this fast, is really exceptionally good, because it basically means that we won't be controlled by either a single company or a single provider.
Yeah.
And we want that.
You likened it in one of your speeches to the Wright brothers to landing on the moon just about 60 years.
Yeah.
That industrial revolution that we saw in aviation travel. How so is this going to change the way we operate in the world with AI?
Well, the Wright brother moment that we talk about, I mean, I talk about two Wright brother moments all the time with friends. The one is Roger Bannister, right? Before Roger Bannister, no human thought that a four-minute mile was possible, or we weren't sure. Roger Bannister runs a four-minute mile. Within a year, 10 other men have done it. Wright brothers fly a plane. Within 60 years, you have a man on the moon, the Apollo Project. Humans are inspired not just by technological advances, but by seeing other humans do things. And so what we're seeing in China in particular is the inspiration drawn from the necessity of compute shortage to massively improve the cost efficiency of these models is one of these incredible breakthroughs that actually comes because of scarcity. And we are now in this new normal where things are going to happen so much faster than we could possibly appreciate.
They predict global banks will cut as many as 200,000 jobs over the next 3 to 5 years as AI encroaches on tasks that are carried out by us mere mortals. Would you agree? Is that a normal projection that some 200,000 jobs could be lost in the financial sector?
First of all, I'll say it would not surprise me to hear that millions of jobs were changed over the next 3 to 5 years. So I'll just start by saying that. Whether or not 200,000 jobs are lost net, it could break either way. But I think what's important to remember is two things. One, job loss comes with it two interesting things. One, a new sort of marketplace dynamic, wherein we now have a new supply of labor, and that supply of labor can go do other interesting things. The other thing that happens when banks actually start to pare down their costs is they can start to deliver more efficient products. And one of the things that we constantly talk about is the idea that banks need to deliver better products more efficiently, more fairly. One of the things that makes banks unfair, as the average person is concerned, is the fact that they are run by people. They're not corrupt institutions. They're institutions where people make mistakes. The fewer people in a lot of these core processes, the better that banking systems probably get. The other thing I would say, Stephen, is, and this is, I mean, for a longer conversation, the thing that people are not paying attention to is not the economic consequences of job loss. Everyone is fixated on this idea of if we lose our jobs, then we won't be able to work and we won't be able to make money.
What do we do next?
But that's not actually what's happening. What's happening is that as we start to automate work, the cost of goods and services will massively come down. Right? We will have a deflationary event. The real question is, what will we do with ourselves? What is our identity then? In a world where we attach so much of our identity to our work, the risk, I think, in all this is an identity displacement crisis. And I talked about this to anyone who will listen.
Yeah.
Focusing on the idea that you will lose your job and therefore you won't have money is misguided. Focusing on the idea that your job may change and therefore you won't feel like you're whole, that's a whole other issue.
We are going to be getting to a point where human beings will get down to, they're talking now, 3 day week. Can you believe it? David Bacher of Corian looks back, not forward, at the 2024 performance of investment markets. Dave and I get together once a month to look at what happened in the month before. This time we had a look at what happened for the full 2024, but I couldn't resist asking him, not for a forecast, but what his gut is telling him is possible or probable to happen in 2025. Let's have a watch.
Sure, I think you might accuse me of sitting on the fence. What I do know is that we are in for a year of market turbulence. Trump's unpredictable decision-making means headlines, risks will be constant. So from a Corian perspective, you know, you don't have to swing at every pitch. We think this year you probably should favor a more balanced approach and investing in a more diversified manner. So, you know, investors should favor stability over high risk bets, companies and asset classes with solid total return potential. That means dividends as well as capital appreciation should be your focus. So I would say that there's a lot of risks out there. Unlike last year where we thought South African assets were cheap, we think it's, you know, a more balanced approach and a little bit more of a defensive approach is probably the way to play 2025.
I love the holidays because I get to catch up on all those podcasts I wanted to listen to. And amongst the one that I listened to three times was the interview by the founder of Stripe, Charlie Munger, one of the last interviews that Charlie Munger did before he passed away. It's just golden, this whole thing. There's so much wisdom in it. But the one thing that emphasized the success of Munger and his business partner, Warren Buffett, is he says that we never went for the spectacular. We always did what made sense. We kept just making sure that we didn't step on landmines, just kept things going straight in the same direction, then let the eighth wonder of the world, compound interest or compound returns, take care of it. Sounds to me like that's going to be the approach that will favor or support you best in the year ahead.
Correct. People forget how important things like dividends are and what a significant role that dividends have on long-term equity returns. And if you look at today's S&P 500, the dividend yield is about 1.3% compared to the US 10-year yield of 4.6%. This spread is unsustainable. So, you know, we think that something has to give. Either, you know, share prices will need to come back a bit, or there needs to be a fall in bond yields. So that's why, as I started with my answer, I think looking at asset classes that give you yield and dividends, as opposed to just thinking what's been a meteoric rise in US equity markets, will continue.
Thanks, David. And that previews, rather premieres at 8:30 this evening. Let's have a look at the markets as we close off for today. And it was a red day on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, 2% industrials and financials down by the top 40 index, down by 1.75%, and resources were down about 0.5%. Bitcoin, 2.5% lower today, sitting at 91,793. As we ended the year, it was over $100,000. But I guess the Bitcoin maximalists will be telling you that don't worry, it's just taking a breather. The Rand was up against the pound and the US dollar, but both of those quotes are now quite a bit weaker from where we were in December. We were around 18 Rand when we went into Christmas. We're now at 19 Rand to the US dollar, and the pound from 22 Rand to 23 Rand. As far as the individual stocks are concerned, Life Healthcare unveiled an incredible transaction today that is, it involves the sale of a UK business that it owns called Life Molecular Imaging. It could get up to $750 million on the sale. That's nearly 14 billion rand. If you think that the whole of Life Healthcare is worth 24 billion rand in its market value, its market capitalization, then you can see the extent of this. Put into context as well, Life Molecular Imaging, that company, only generates about 7% of Life Healthcare's turnover. So it is a relatively small part of the business. It's quite a risky part of the business. It's a new development in an area that is not core to Life Healthcare, but is core to the company that's bought the business. It's called Radio Pharmaceuticals, and it's a subsidiary of Lantheus, a big UK business. So that's the reason why Life Healthcare was up 3.5% today. I'd wager to think that that share price is probably going to be a little bit stronger as analysts have had an opportunity to read through and fully absorb the value of this transaction. Life gets $350 million up front, which they're going to be using $200 million of which to repay to shareholders. So a juicy dividend coming there. Pick and Pay continues to move in the right direction. I mentioned earlier that Sasol was up 2% on that stronger oil price, and BHP in a generally slow market or soggy market today. Those were notable winners. On the way down, Sun International down by nearly 5%, as was Brait. Motus, which is the leading motor retailer, 4.7%. And then Telkom, 4.3%. And just to close off, as far as the tables are concerned, there were no new highs today, not a single new high, but a batch of new lows
led by Tsoho Sun, AECI, AB InBev, Exaro, Transaction Capital. Wow, look at that Transaction Capital price. And Bytes, which is the UK business spun off from Altron some years ago. To be fair to Bytes, it has had a heck of a run in the years before, so wouldn't be too concerned about that. Well, it's been such a pleasure, as it always is, to be in the hot seat here for the BizNews Briefing. I'll be back again tomorrow, same time, same place. I'd urge you to pick up on the two premieres that we've got tonight. Gigi Alcock on that very strong story about the poisoning of the kids and what's actually behind it and why the politicians need to be focusing their attention on the relevant issues. And then we'll have David Bacher looking back on 2024. Until then, from the team at BizNews, cheerio.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.